Welcome back to Classy Coders, the podcast where computer science educators and technology professionals come together to explore the present and future of CS education. Together, we're bridging the gap between classrooms and careers, equipping the next generation for a tech-driven world. Today's episode is another deep dive into the world of AI, a topic full of excitement and concerns, especially in the context of the classroom. The promises of AI are vast and full of mystery, but today's conversation is grounded in the realities of the current system upon which AI is built. Will AI push us over the cliff when it comes to declining literacy and math scores in the US? Does it sideline genuine connections between students, contributing to isolation? What are the current, real ethical dilemmas surrounding AI's adoption? From environmental impact to intellectual property rights and the hidden labor that powers these systems, we're asking the tough questions. But it's not all doom and gloom. We end on a note of positivity around the potential of AI for creatives, with smaller, more strategic uses being at the forefront of this movement. Stick around, you won't want to miss it. This is Classy Coders.
We have all these examples of declining literacy rates among children and adults, and my fear is that AI is going to really, is just going to push us over the cliff when it comes to those problems. We have actual real problems in classrooms that are going to be sidelined because we're trying to deal with AI in whatever way we end up dealing with it. And that was sort of an interesting like takeaway that came out of that AI education summit. That there were a bunch of professors there, higher teacher educators, classroom teachers, people working in the field of education. And we would have these investors come in front of us and say, well, AI is going to do all this stuff to help you in the classroom. And a professor would stand up and say, well, we actually kind of know what would help us in the classroom. It's smaller class sizes, better paid teachers, more resources. Is AI going to help us with that? Right. No, it's not. It's just adding another thing on top of these like fundamental systemic issues that we've been researching for decades and we have a really good understanding of from a scholarly perspective. Not to say a complete understanding, right? There's lots to know about, but yeah.
Right. Hindering those like outcomes and stuff like that is it's just what a fascinating problem to be presented with that I'm not 100% sure if we've ever truly encountered. Like, I know that people were worried, like, oh, TV's here, kids aren't going to read books.
Right.
And when books became popular, people were like, nobody talks anymore, everybody just reads books.
Right.
You know, which is, like, wild to even think about.
Yeah, those, like, reactionary cultural moments.
Right, radio, yeah, exactly. Yeah, books being a disruptive, media-based interruption into the world. It's like, okay, like, let's take a moment, let's take a beat. But I do get concerned, I get very concerned over the fact that I don't think anything of this scale and of this capacity has ever really hit the classrooms like this in terms of reading outcomes, writing outcomes, math, science, everything. Like, if you have a person that you can whisper to next to you that knows everything that's ever been known, how are you not going to use that? Like, the temptation is just absolutely
insane. It's a seductive thing, right?
Yeah.
It's incredibly seductive. And everyone is vulnerable to that. You know, my worst thing that I hate doing, I hate writing emails. I hate writing emails. It's the worst. I'm a bad communicator. Okay. I need to like work on that in my life, right? But if I had AI, it would craft the perfect PC email for me. It would take 2 seconds and I'd just be able to move on with my life. But the thing that demonstrates to the person I'm sending that email to is just complete contempt for the task of trying to communicate with them. I can do that, right? I can choose to try to communicate with that person. But AI gives me an escape ramp where I can just choose to not deal with that shortcoming that I have, that I can't write a PC email, right? And I've heard that example. I'm sort of stealing that anecdote from my uncle, who literally called it, I can't write a PC email. But
I know, I'm pretty sure you're very politically correct as a human being.
I am, yeah.
But yeah, no, I mean, I get the concept of, yeah, it's like, that's an interesting way of phrasing it, too, is like, I'm just showing contempt for the effort that I maybe have to put to in order to communicate with anyone, everyone. And it's like, it makes me think of, you know, like, what do I have contempt for in my own life that I'm using like AI to sort of approximate or get closer to. I'm also somebody who believes that everything is a skill. Everything is learnable. You can get stronger in every aspect of every minute little thing. And the concept of creating marketing plans or something like that is, again, I will say I have used AI to help me make marketing plans and marketing campaigns and getting ideas. But I always sort of couch it in the idea of like, I'm prompting it based on what I think is right. And then it's helping me overcome executive dysfunction in order to create a well thought out outlined marketing plan, you know, like a long term marketing plan. That's a difficult task. It's a heavy task. Normally it takes weeks, months, days, but I can do it in 30 minutes. But what skill set am I not strengthening then whenever I use this product? And then also like how much power and how much water am I using? You know, of course, that just if that's so something that weighs on you.
I completely relate to that, right? I have autism. I have executive dysfunction issues all the time. That's a huge struggle for me, right? And I think about, especially in the classroom, you know, as a teacher, I have a kid who like, they just can't like sit down and make an outline. They just can't organize their life or their stuff. They have all these problems. And I could put them in front of ChatGPT and say, we'll have a dialogue and we'll see if we come up with some good action steps. Or I could sit that kid down with another kid who solved those problems or another kid who's struggling with those problems and have them collaborate and figure it out. Maybe they don't come up with like the best answer, right? But those relationships are... those relationships are a kind of knowledge. The question you asked about, like, what would I do if I had someone next to me who knew everything there was to know about the world? Why wouldn't I talk to them? People are surrounded by people who know all sorts of things. There's a great anecdote from the summit that's on this topic. There was an AI evangelist person who was talking about, like, oh, I was trying to buy a used car. And I used ChatGPT and it said, give me 5 things I should do before I buy this used car. And it spit out verbatim the advice my mom gave to me 15 years ago. It was time for me to buy a new car, right? And I'm like, this is a dystopian nightmare. You asked this computer to do this thing when you could just ask my mom. And she's a really cool person. You guys would get along great. You know, like, it's not even so much that we're trying to give people more access to information. We've never had more access to information in our society in the U.S. ever. The internet is horrible and also completely filled with misinformation, and it's really hard to find things sometimes. But also, if you just take Wikipedia by itself, one site, that's more access to knowledge than anyone has had in the U.S. at any point prior, right? Unless you went to a university or you had an encyclopedia at your house or whatever, right? It is the thing that worries me more with students, especially, is replacing human collaboration and human relationships with an AI model that can provide good information to you sometimes, but that also just robs you of the opportunity to develop a community of people who provide that kind of support to you. That's what being in academia is about, fundamentally. Right. When I was in grad school, the whole point of my grad program was to induct me into the field of education as a professional. And being inducted into the field that way requires me to meet people and to know what they work on and to like know what they're thinking about and to weigh their different perspectives against each other and to find my place in the field and the topics I'm interested in. If I use ChatGPT to just spit out information about education to me, if I remember all that stuff, I may have a great understanding of education as a like consumer of that data, but I'm not going to have the professional experiences and the professional relationships that actually lead to real success in that field. And I think that that can be said of almost any field, performance, humanities, mathematics, science. Those relationships are really important, really important.
Yeah. And well, I mean, it's also fascinating that like this happened after a global pandemic, this being the rise of generative AI. And at this point, you know that you, whoever I'm talking to, knows that isolation is bad. We all know that human interaction is a life necessity.
Yes.
A global pandemic, if it taught you nothing else, could teach you that. And if this tool is increasing isolation, then that's something to be concerned about. Just plain and simple, cut and dry. And not every role, not everything, not every moment of your life needs to be human connection. I get that. But the fact that we just went through a global pandemic and people are like, it's not a big deal that we're taking away human connection, especially among kids, is something to pause about in terms of AI in the classroom.
I think about that particular issue as a discoverability crisis. The internet and search engines and information retrieval has been degrading for like 5 years, probably due to ad revenue pressures and all sorts of other things. And there's lots of different ways to address that. There's companies that have you pay for their search engine and they use that money that you're paying to improve your search results and try to like recapture some of that discoverability. But AI is this like buffer between you and the source material. And AI, for all of its claims that it will be able to like link to real sources and like that, the technology just can't do that reliably, right? It can do it sometimes. It cannot do it reliably. That is a fundamental reality of how that technology works. If you can't follow that source to the person who it originated from, if you can't form even just the like passive relationship of, oh, I know this, I know about this author and I've read their book, right? You are isolating yourself into this bubble where you're completely dependent on the AI tool to retrieve information for you. And there's also this discoverability. There's something I'm super passionate about in the classroom is related to this. There's rhizomatic learning pedagogies. Discoverability is a huge part of learning. If you're reading a Wikipedia article, we're trying to retrieve information, you're not just getting the information you tried to retrieve. You're also getting a lot of contextual information around the information you're interested in. And you see random links and like interesting little tidbits, like, oh, maybe I'll like save that for later or whatever, right? It's a virtuous cycle of discovering things, right? But ChatGPT, it's a closed-ended thing. It pushes you to just ask the question and get the answer, which is kind of antithetical to learning from my perspective, and also from the perspective of many people who have been thinking about this for like 100 years.
Well, I mean, yeah, absolutely. It's like, you know, the fundamental idea that every learner is different, you know, like when I was going through school, it was like, you're a visual learner or you're a kinesthetic learner or you're, you know, or something. Or
since like debunked, I will say.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I was like, even when it was happening, I was like, I'm none of these things completely. I'm pretty much all of them, depending on the context of what I'm learning. So this can't be right, but
you should have written a book.
Right, yeah, apparently. But, like, it's the idea of this discoverability, the idea of this context within and surrounding learning is something that's super near and dear to me, because I bring this up almost every podcast, but I'm learning Japanese. Yeah. And the idea of, so Japanese is a pictorially based language of, like, these kanji are pictures, and within those pictures are pieces of other pictures. And you have to know what the pieces potentially indicate. And a lot of the ways that I'm learning these words is through that context of pictures. I can look at a symbol and I can be like, okay, that's the kanji for person. That's the kanji for water. That's the kanji for everywhere. And it's like, oh, swimming. You know, I can make this mental model, and it's all through context. It's all through what you call discoverability. And sometimes I have to look up a kanji because my textbook doesn't give me enough context of just the kanji itself. I go to these other websites where it breaks down what all the individual pieces mean, and then that's how I form my context, and that's how I learn the symbol, and that's how I associate meaning.
Right.
And if that is the fundamental way in which we learn, then learning something in a black box is never going to cut it. And although the black box can give you the answer that you're looking for, even if you're not giving it the perfect prompt, which is a fascinating thing. Another alluring thing about this AI is, like, I can describe the kind of cabinet bracket that I have without actually, you know, giving it a name, without knowing what it's called, without knowing what tools I need, and it can tell me how to fix it. It can take this context from you and spit out what you might want it to spit out at you. But from a foundational, real learning aspect, it's a black box with black walls and a voice, and to think about it that way, because I knew I had reservations about how it was teaching kids, but I don't have the pedagogical background of a teacher like yourself, and so I have red flags, but it's hard to put it into words, and I think that discoverability aspect is huge.
Yeah, and it's just one slice of it, right?
Right.
And I think the thing I want to, like, really make sure comes across here in this conversation is I obviously have strong opinions about this. I am way down one end of the spectrum on the AI evangelist versus Luddite scale, whatever. But, you know, not every educator, it feels that way. I don't feel like everyone needs to feel that way. I have my own value system that I'm making those decisions based off of. But if you are a teacher, if you're an educator, or you work in education, you have been sold BS in a lot of different situations for a really long time. And I think educators are primed to be critical and to try to think through what is literally happening, what might be harms that come about because of these technologies or how we're using it with kids. If a teacher just decides to uncritically swallow the AI hype because they don't understand the technology and they're just being told that it's really important, I want to encourage everyone to question that assumption. Even if you end up coming back around to your same perspective, question that assumption and dig into it, because it's like standardized testing. It's like personalized learning. It's like smart boards. It's like X, Y, like I could talk for an hour about all of the BS. It's the one laptop per child initiative. It's all of these boondoggles that we've just been sold for a long time. And because educators don't have any political power in the United States at all, we have no way of pushing back against those things except in the very local context of our individual schools and classrooms. So use that power in your individual school and classroom to try to advocate for kids. And if that advocacy makes you end up returning and finding a way to use ChatGPT, that's fine with me. I won't do that. But you know, if you want to talk about it, please come on the podcast. That'd be great. But in the interest of helping people understand the critiques, because I think the critiques are not being spotlighted enough, I think we're getting better at spotlighting those critiques. I've been noticing more journalism around this topic as time goes on, which is really nice.
Love it.
So if you have someone who you're talking to and they're like, AI is the future, here are some areas of concern that you might find useful to look into. So we talked a little bit about environmental issues and power use, right? Someone would say, well, electricity, like, why not? I have an electric car. That's green, right? No, not really. Not yet, until we transition our energy grid away from fossil fuels, right? So when we have these data centers, they're using up a ton of electricity and fresh water to cool down their computers. That's a real environmental impact that's happening right now. And there's lots of journalism out there. Go check it out. The other class of concerns has to do with the impact of the technology on students' experiences in school. What are the different messages that ChatGPT is sending, both implicitly and explicitly? Is it safe for a kid to use ChatGPT? Will it hallucinate something horrible? Will it hallucinate bad information and lead that kid down the wrong path? When a kid types something into ChatGPT, are the companies retaining that information? Because that's illegal. You're not allowed to do that.
Right.
And I think every company would say, oh, well, we don't do anything like that. But we have a lot of evidence that these companies will lie to us about those questions. You know, if you look, Meta has known for a really long time about the negative impacts of Instagram and its algorithm on teen girls. And they just kept that information secret. Now we know. And I don't think that we should just give these people our trust, right? They should have to prove to us what is good about this in a classroom through empirical evidence in the way that we've been doing it for 100 years, right? Sociological research. We can do that. It's possible.
Right. We're super good at it.
Yeah, right. And it's not to say it's a perfect system. It's not. But like, come on. Scientific method's all right.
Exactly. Right, I feel like it's been tried and tested enough, you know, probably. Who knows?
So that's the other class of concerns. What are the impacts that it's having on kids? And then there's a whole other set of, I would call them values-based concerns around AI. I would say environmental issues are values-based, but also I think that's a concrete harm. You know, people can turn on their tap and see like awful, like unfiltered data center water coming out of their tap. That's pretty bad. That's a material concern. Intellectual property concerns. I'm an artist. I'm a musician. I was never compensated by Spotify or OpenAI or any of these other companies that are using my work to create their AI models. I made music that they're using to make money. In any other situation, I would be owed some money in that context. And you can look at the journalism right now, and there's really not a whole lot of argument that's false, right? Like, you have these companies, they're trying to make deals with publishing houses to kind of defray that issue. But I'm not a publisher. My writing and music is all over the internet. It's certainly in their models. And if I sue them, what's going to happen? Probably nothing. Right. I have almost no agency over that issue. And it's complete wholesale exploitation from me, right? I didn't get into music to make money, but also I don't want there to be, again, one more technology that makes it impossible to make a living as an artist, right?
Right.
That already happened with streaming. Like, right. Let's not do it again, please. So that's a concern. Like, what are you owed by these companies when they just use your data? We have people from these companies on the record saying, if we have to abide by intellectual property law in the US right now, whether or not you disagree with copyright, like, I'm not a copyright stan, but these people have said, based on what the current law is, if it is enforced, LLMs are unworkable as a technology.
Right.
It is a technology that is 100% based on exploitation with no accountability.
Right.
So that, and people have different opinions about that. That's a values-based concern, right?
Right, yeah.
I think the last class of concerns is the labor impact of AI. Not in the future, not when it takes your job away, but right now. AI models like ChatGPT consume the entire internet, which is full of vile language and vile ideas, right? That's not news to anybody. Those vile ideas are in the data set. They will emerge, right? We've seen a ton of examples of that over many, many years already.
Right.
And I don't even need to get into it because it's kind of distressing. But if you're interested, you know, that there's lots of stuff to look at there. The one concrete example I'll give is the AI models need to be moderated. The models need to be tweaked to avoid those white supremacist ideas, racist ideas, misogynist ideas, incel culture, all sorts of stuff like that, right? They need to be trained away from that stuff because it's already in the data set. And the way they do that is with human labor. They have human moderators that are sitting in a data center and looking at prompts and saying, that's bad, don't do that. That's bad, don't do that. That's bad, don't do that. And they're receiving a huge amount of vile material that's going to deal psychic damage to them for however long. Lots of great reporting out of 404 Media about that side of things, like content moderation. Wow. And also, think about the expenditure of resources to do that. It's not even just environmental. It's not even just the data that they're stealing from everyone. They have these workers who are doing this incredibly menial task that's at the foundation of this supposedly miracle technology that has no negative impacts, right? And the worst part about that is that these workers are often in countries where they can be paid a very small amount of money for that really hard labor. Lots of great research. Dr. Timnit Gebru, who I've mentioned a couple times here, has written several papers about this. DIBR is the name of their research collective of a bunch of these researchers. They focus on like existing harms of AI. That's a great place to go. In fact, I'm just going to look up their website here so I can put it on there. Oh, sorry, not DBIR. That's different. That's Design-Based Research Implementation Research. DAIR, Distributed AI Research Institute. Apologies. So it's DAIR-institute.org. Wonderful place. We'll throw it in the show notes for those of you who are interested. It's a great starting point. So just to review, we've got environmental concerns. We've got pedagogical learning concerns. That's where I live. That's where my interest area is.
Yep.
We have intellectual property concerns, data generation concerns, and then we have labor concerns. Those four venues of issues are the sites of existing harm right now. So if you are looking for evidence that AI has these big downsides, that's where you can find it. And bring those ideas to your colleagues. Bring those ideas to your AI evangelist friends and ask them, like, hey, like I noticed you're using ChatGPT to generate a lot of images. Did you know that, like, if you generate 100 images, it's like burning half a gallon of gasoline, like energy related. I don't know if those metrics are exactly right, so don't check me on that.
No worries.
But that's the idea of it, right? They might be like, yeah, I don't care. Or they might be like, oh, crap. Like, I drive an electric car. I try to minimize my fossil fuel footprint. I don't fly. Like, that sucks. I'm not going to do that anymore. Right. I'm looking at the research right now. Okay, so this recently came out. So there's these new AI video generation models, right?
Right.
To create one image with these new high fidelity models, it would consume all of the charge in your smartphone instantly. You have a fully charged smartphone, you have a generated image, your smartphone's dead.
Wow.
If that happened to you when you tried to generate that image, I bet you wouldn't do that often.
Right.
It feels wasteful because you see the energy being consumed right in front of you. And the other thing to remember is that when you pay a subscription to ChatGPT, you're paying for their energy consumption. But they're not charging you as much as they should to offset that cost. At some point, the price is going to go up, and you're going to have to be paying ChatGPT's electric bills. When that happens, what will that be like? You know? So, again, one end of the spectrum. You don't have to listen to just me, please. But it's... trying to couch that as much as possible, because I feel very
I get it. There are these wonderful use cases and these interesting benefits and efficiencies, and like one person can run an entire company, or small businesses being able to use these opportunities and things like that. But I wanted to do this episode especially because the more I learn, the more I'm intrigued by the silence around these concepts and principles when it talks about AI. There's a lot of doom in terms of taking jobs and destroying entire career paths and things like that. And yeah, sure, those are bleak promises that may or may not come to fruition, and they're something that we need to be concerned about. But the things that we're talking about are, they're happening. It is
not
current. Yeah, exactly. It's not theoretical. It's not something that may or may not happen. It's current. But I did want to write in the last couple of minutes before we before we set out is Code Virginia is creating an AI pathways curriculum.
Yes, thank you for asking me about that.
Where does that sit in this conversation? And what problem or pain point for teachers is that addressing?
Yeah. Okay, that, so I bet people will be really surprised to know that I'm working on this AI Pathways curriculum.
Right, exactly. And that's what the interesting
thing. Right. Yeah. So the AI Pathways curriculum we're working on is intended to help students build technical skills in the field of AI. Not prompt engineering, not getting everyone a subscription to ChatGPT and trying to get results out of it. Right. We're interested in having them learn the fundamental statistical concepts and then the coding and engineering skills needed to build their own AI models in the classroom as part of a, like a structured course, right? So we're not interested in creating consumers of AI. We're interested in helping people understand the technology and maybe become builders of the next thing, right? Well, you talked a little bit at the beginning about this, like what if this technology never gets better? What if it's just this AI slop machine forever? That would really be awful. But what if we could train students to understand this stuff and then they create something that's actually really beneficial for society? And if they have the critique, if they have the understanding of the technologies, they understand all of the harms that are happening right now, how all this exploitation is going on, they can imagine a better future for AI. And maybe that future is everyone has AI in their homes. Maybe that future is we use AI to help in some really narrow use cases. There's lots of situations I can imagine where having an AI model that's trained on a specific data set is super powerful. And I'll just give one example of this from a musician's perspective, because I think that's an interesting side of this. I'm a musician. I make my own music. I make original music. I know lots of people who do that. And we are all really interested in AI, not because we want it to generate music for us, but because we can feed our work into models like that and create new kinds of art. So I have a friend who is a composer, and what they did is take a singer's voice and composed some like little snippets for them to sing, and they recorded all of those snippets and then used the AI model to generate new melodies with this person's voice based on their performances. Then they wrote a piece where the singer was singing live with her voice. That use of AI actually escapes a lot of the concerns that I'm worried about, right? The data set is really small. Everyone's consenting to being in the system, right? The AI isn't being used to exploit anybody. It's just creating art using computing power. And the person who made it had to plug their computer into their wall and pay for the power, right?
Right.
It's not like they were being subsidized by the government to do any of that stuff, right?
Right.
It was just happening in their room with these two people in the computer. And I think that's really exciting. I don't know that I'm interested in that kind of art personally, but that's a cool thing. And I don't think I can object to that based on my value structure at all. And I would just be really interested to see more people thinking about AI, not as this big monolithic thing that uses all this energy and data, but as a philosophy about software development, an approach to software development that can be surgical, that can be used in lots of these little situations where it has maximum impact with minimal harm. I think it's possible at the small scale, but we've been shown over the past couple of years that at the large scale, it's very difficult to escape those concerns. So that's what I would say. I think that the course, the AI Pathways course, is interested in helping students learn the basics and create these small models that are achievable within their community, within their interest area, and then be able to deploy those models in interesting ways where they're not, you know, consuming, it's not a consumptive act, it's a generative, creative practice.
Right. What a great example, especially from a music field, because the chord chart or the, what's it called? What you learn in music
theory.
The circle of fifths.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. So there are only so many tones that the human ear can hear. There's only a certain number of music notes. Like maybe AI finds a new one. I don't know if it's like the periodic table of elements. Probably not. But I know very little about music. More similar than you might think. Right. Yeah, exactly. But what an interesting idea. Like we know within this fixed structure of music theory, I want you to take my inputs and create alternate timeline versions of them or something like that. And like within a fixed framework, that's a really interesting place for AI to play around because it'll just come up with different permutations. That's its only job. That's what it's meant to do. It's not taking every song and you're not saying, write me a banger. And then taking the amalgamation of every song that's ever been written and creating this sort of median version of
the most
like,
boring possible piece of music ever heard. Right.
Yeah, exactly. Like, oh my gosh, what a travesty. But, you know, like within this structure, like I want you to play in this sandbox. Yeah. And what can AI do in that? And all of the concerns that we just talked about are nullified in that particular instance, which
is like, quote, locally sourced. It's sort of like a weird kind of like funny
farm to table AI.
Farm to table AI. But like, I think that's a real heuristic for people to be thinking about. Like, where does the data come from? Where does the energy come from? Where is the computing coming from? If it's coming from sources that you control, that feels great to me. And I really can't object to it. I would love to have, I have some hobbies and hobby projects in mind that might use machine learning or AI. And I don't have any qualms about using the technology. And there are folks in my kind of like area of AI criticism that feel differently about that. And I don't think there's anything wrong with teaching a kid how it works. Like, please, let's do that, right? Let's teach at least the people who are interested how it works so that they have like a reality-based framework to work off of when they are building software or using technologies.
Right. Yeah, let's empower these kids with the understanding of all sides as opposed to the promises that the vested interests are espousing. You know, I mean, like, that's an interesting thing to be concerned about. And, you know, aside from a value system, it's let's take a look at who stands to gain. And if it's not somebody in the room right now, then maybe we should pause, you know?
Yes, always, right? We finally boiled down AI to being a collective labor action problem. All right, what's next?
Yeah.
What's next, Alan?
We got to it. We got there. I didn't know if it was going to happen, but it took an hour and 10 minutes and we figured it out.
We got it. Yeah. Awesome. But this has been really fun. This has been great. I don't get this soapbox very often, so I hope I didn't abuse it.
I'm here for it. I loved it. I was riveted, so I really, really appreciate this because it's helped illuminate a lot of things for me about AI from a layman's standpoint. You know, I have a theater degree. That's the plain and simple truth. And although I worked at the Apple store for a number of years and I'm very good at computers, it's not something that I would call my expertise. But it doesn't take an expert to understand the fundamentals of this technology. It is a technology that is easy to wrap your mind around if you get in front of the right person who's willing to talk it through with you.
Right.
And almost as soon as that first conversation is over with that person who somewhat knows what they're talking about, you will walk away with a very different outlook on AI and generative AI specifically. And I think that that's what I wanted to get to with this podcast is like, we need to take a step back and really look at this technology. And like, it's not the end of the world, but it's also not the new world necessarily.
Right. It's not any of those things yet.
Right.
I want to close with your very life-affirming, like, learning-affirming thing that, like, everything is a skill. You can learn anything.
Yes.
You, person listening to this, I don't care what your background is, you can know about this. You can understand it. It is not so complicated that you can't have at least an abstract understanding and enough to make decisions off of. And that, I think that is beautiful. And I think CodeVA is just all about trying to make that happen for people. Like to give people the resources to learn anything about computing, no matter how complicated it might seem or that it, like people try to convince you that it is.
Yes. Yes. So please visit our website, codevirginia.org, to learn more about our AI Pathways initiative, as well as our other wonderful products and initiatives. We have a computer science magazine coming out. Should be really cute. Yes, it's really cute. It's already out. The first edition already exists. We just want
go
you to get it.
Get it.
Yes, go and get it. But other than that, I really appreciate you taking the time, John. Anything, any other last thoughts, comments? I mean, I think that we ended on a good point there.
I think I'll just say keep it classy.
Keep it classy. Oh, great. I appreciate that. Okay, I will end this recording. Tune in next month for two more amazing episodes of Classy Coders. In July, we talked to a lab school director from Chesapeake who is empowering students in computer science, as well as a vice president of data management at a national bank, about her experience in a tech-driven career spanning over 15 years. It's a wonderful examination of the connections between early engagement with tech and a career that can change the trajectory of multiple generations in a family. Hit that subscribe button, and if you'd like to learn more about Code Virginia and the work we do every day to enrich the lives of students and teachers across the country, visit us at codevirginia.org.